and I don't think that the United States would stand for it.
Now, one case has gone to an appeals court, but it was ruled that because the killing took place on Mexican soil, it's not within U.S. jurisdiction?
Correct. A couple of years ago, a 15-year-old was shot and killed in Juarez, Mexico, by a border agent. His name was Sergio Hernandez Guerica. He was shot in the face and died instantly, and he was standing in Mexico. The family sued the U.S. government for wrongful death, and the case was actually thrown out because he died in Mexico. He has no standing. Mexicans cannot sue in U.S. court if the incident occurred in Mexico. So there's no legal recourse. Basically, what we have now is a system where border agents can fire their weapons into Mexico, kill someone, and not suffer any legal repercussions.
Now, President Obama was just in Mexico. The debate around immigration is raging now. Right. The legislation that is being introduced calls for thousands more border guards. Talk about the significance of this for what you're finding.
What I've found in this particular investigation is one of the reasons this is happening is because we have poorly trained guards. In 2006 and 2007, we hired about 8,000 more, lowered standards. And we have a lot of rookies on the force now. And they're basically taught to shoot their weapons. If we increase the Border Patrol force by thousands more, as you say, increase militarization at the border, I think we're going to have more incidents here. We're talking about dealing with immigration or immigrants in a militaristic way as opposed to in a human way. And what we're seeing now is the result of using guns instead of diplomacy. And I suspect, since we've seen such an increase in the past couple of years, that this is going to escalate.
The Senate immigration plan is centered around securing the border as a condition for granting a path of citizenship for all these undocumented workers. So do you see that as a case of concern?
It's a terrible case of concern. We have actual large U.S. cities along the U.S.-Mexico border that are becoming militarized. San Diego, El Paso, Nuevo Laredo, Nogales, who have drones flying around in their backyards. They have border guards that are running up and down the border all over the place. We have thousands of armed-to-the-teeth guards that are aiming their weapons at Mexico. So it feels like a war zone down there, and I think it's going to get a little bit worse.
The response of the authorities as you did this piece—
You're suspecting that there is a response. Every time I've tried to get responses from authorities, any sort of information, documents, any sort of answers to the questions that I had, I've been met with mute responses. There are no responses. These cases are locked down. I don't know the names of the agents. I don't know why this has happened. In many of these cases, there's actual video. Video cameras are up and down the U.S.-Mexico border. That video is not available to the public. So these cases have been shut down and closed, not just for months, even after the investigations have concluded, we still don't get the information.
John Carlos Frey, I want to thank you very much for being here and for this important report. Investigative reporter working on behalf of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. His latest piece called Over the Line appeared Monday in the Washington Monthly. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. And that does it for our show. We're hiring an annual giving manager to head up our individual giving program. Apply if you're passionate about funding independent media and have experience with online fundraising, annual giving campaigns, donor relations, and database management. You can find out more at democracynow.org. Apply immediately. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felsar, and Mate Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Martinez DeRosa, Nemo Allen. Special thanks to Julie Cross, Rebecca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
This is Donna with your WUSB concert billboard for Sunday, May 5th. Milagro will be at 89 North in Patchogue. Peter Tork will be at Iridium, Manhattan, 8 p.m. Brunch with Dan Donnelly will be at the Grey Horse Tavern in Bayport, 1 p.m. Sterling Sachs will be at Vito's Pizza, Port Jefferson, 5 p.m. The Living Room presents Ben Robb, 7 p.m. The University Cafe Stony Brook presents Reckless Eric and Amy Rigby, 7 p.m. West Palm Saloon in East Northport presents The Spuds at 3 p.m. Your concert billboard for Monday, May 6th. Philip Namenworth, the Boogie Woogie Mystic, and Always Something will be at the Cutting Room, Manhattan. Beyond the Beehive will be at City Winery at 8. Your billboard for Tuesday, May 7th. The Dix Hills Performing Arts Center in Dix Hills proudly presents The Mostly Barbershop A Cappella Show. Spin Doctors, James Matta at the Brooklyn Bowl, 8 p.m. Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola presents Essentially Ellington Alumni Group at 11:30 p.m. Looking ahead to Wednesday, May 8th, Steve Earle and the Dukes will be at the Music Hall of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. Tune in to WUSB Stony Brook for the widest variety of music and talk. Go to Concert Billboard online at WUSB.FM for the fullest listing of live shows. And stay tuned to WUSB.
Where the time is 2 minutes after 6 o'clock, you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time for Off the Wall. Okay, we promised we wouldn't play as much of the theme this week because we played all of it last week, and time is fleeting. So, welcome. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, where you must have heard by now the Dow closed above 15,000. How about that, huh? First time ever. You know what that means to us? You know what that means to us as Americans, as individuals, as people? Not a damn thing. It means nothing. It means nothing. The same exact crap is going to go on as it did before. And maybe some rich people are a little richer tonight. Maybe the caviar and the champagne is out. But it doesn't affect our lives one tiny iota. And you know, I just wish that we had some control over how the news is disseminated to us. We have no control over this. But I wish we did, where we could say, you know, we don't want to hear what this meaningless number that does not affect us in any significant way. It's an indicator of some of the most powerful stocks and companies and things like that. That's about the extent of my knowledge of it. But I know it does not affect anybody as far as how their day is going to look the next day, except to maybe make you think that things are a certain way. But look around you. They're not. They're not really changing. And if they do change, it's because of things that are done locally in your neighborhood. How many people in your town are still out of work? How many businesses are shuttered? How many homes foreclosed? How about that every night? You see that statistic? Instead of this meaningless, no, I don't know what the number means. I really don't. I just know when I was a kid, it was something like 2,000 and now it's 15,000. And yeah, does that mean that we're that much better off than we were? I don't think it does. I just think it means there's more going on and things are more expensive. I don't know. I don't care. I think most people don't. Yet, we accept this every single day. We accept being told what the Dow Jones average and all these other stock markets in various places, what their numbers are. And you got the crawlers in the bottom of screens, and you've got all kinds of meaningless statistics that are thrown at you all the time, designed to keep you from thinking about anything important. Like the fact that the Nets were eliminated. And other things, you know, not just sports, but, you know, news and important local things. Stuff that you could actually have a profound effect upon. Because believe me, you have no effect on meaningless numbers. All right, got that out of my system at least. I'd like to read some mail because we've been getting mail, and it's always good to read the mail when we get it. We always read the mail, but I mean read it out loud and share it with other listeners because, well, maybe it'll make more listeners write more mail. And then the internet will get all clogged with off-the-wall mail. If you would like to contribute to that, otw@2600.com, that's our email address. And yes, we do use email. We don't communicate via Facebook. We don't communicate via Twitter. Oh, not that these aren't amazing tools and fun ways to live your life, but as far as something lasting, something meaningful, where people express themselves in sentences, and you're able to do with it as you will, save it, resend it, whatever. So many people send me things on Facebook, and I don't even see them until the next time I happen to wander through there. And their interface is so terrible that even when someone sends me a direct message on Facebook, I don't see it on the main page. You have to click the right little bubble and know where you're going. And yeah, it's my fault for not knowing that. I know. Silly me for wasting my time on day-to-day drudgery like living my life. All right. Let's see if I can get to these letters. And thank you for writing letters, because so few people do. I don't mean to us. I mean in general. I've given up on postal mail, but regular just email now. That's getting to be a rarity. Incredible. Anyway, here's a letter from the Netherlands. And this is something, actually, I wanted to talk about this last week and totally got overshadowed by all my depressing news stories about various things. And this listener wanted to share happier news. Last week, he actually said this last week, he said last week because he knew I'd be reading it this week. But yes, tonight when I'm writing this, you were talking about all that negative news on gun violence. I tried to call in but couldn't get through because I wanted to help you end the show on a happier note. I was beyond hope, or I was beyond help at that point. But thanks for the effort and the thought. That episode, you were also talking about changes in countries, and today, or last week, April 30th, a big change happened in my nation of the Netherlands. We have a new monarch. Instead of Queen Beatrix, we now have a king. King Willem-Alexander and his wife, Queen Maxima, have taken over the reins of this country. This was, of course, cause for a big celebration, and seeing all those people having fun and genuinely being happy making me very proud of my country. Sorry, Marcel. Thank you so much, Marcel, for those thoughts. And you know, something to think about. A lot of us will say that the monarchy is outdated and useless and just a throwback to prior times. We spend a lot of time criticizing institutions, and there is something wrong with every single institution that exists, from schools to churches to sports to monarchies to government, you name it. There is something foul in every single one of them, but there's also good that can be gotten out of every single one of them. And if you don't recognize that, there's no hope of improving it, because you'll just condemn it and walk away and not listen. And I hear way too much of that. Way too much. So, if people are out in the streets of Amsterdam having fun and just celebrating a bit of their history, which we might find odd, we might find confusing, but it's something that's that belongs to them. And, you know, a confession, whenever I go to England, I'm always blown away by the whole monarchy system that still exists to this day. It's a fascinating history. It really is. And that's why there are so many stories and plays written about this kind of thing, because it's intriguing. But horrible, too. All right, thanks again for that that letter. Here's another one. Hello, Emmanuel. Normally, I find myself agreeing with your political views, but so many times I get this kind of a letter, and I know exactly what they're referring to. I disagree entirely with your stated opinion on the April 23rd and 30th shows regarding the U.S. Senate. Usually it's guns, but okay, this particular time it's the U.S. Senate, and let's go into some more detail here. One of the reasons that the House of Representatives and the Senate exist as separate entities is because each state can benefit from proportional representation based on population in one, which is the House, and equal representation in the other, which is the Senate. If we were to change the Senate to proportional representation, you may as well just do away with the Senate entirely, because at that point it's redundant. Let's leave that topic separate for another day. I'm surprised no one else has, to my knowledge, made any similar comments. And what do you have against North Dakota? South Dakota, I can understand, but North Dakota? Yeah, I meant South Dakota when I said North Dakota. I'm sorry about that. And thanks, Dave, for writing in with that that opinion. I still think, though, having witnessed what happened with the gun registration fallacy that failed to make it through the Senate, even though the majority of the Senate supported it, because they didn't have the necessary 60 votes to override a filibuster by the Republicans, which apparently now is used every time they disagree with something, because of that, the measure died, even with the majority. I can't figure it out. What does it take for Democrats to get any kind of control? When they're in the minority, they don't have control then. When they're in the majority, they still don't have control. You know, unanimous. Every single politician is a Democrat. I think they'd still find a way to mess it up. But no, that's not on them. There's something fundamentally wrong with the structure where that can happen. And yeah, you know, I have a problem. I have a problem with something of that magnitude, something of that importance. Having, you call it equal representation. And how is it equal? How is it equal when you have a one particular state, and just because it's called a state, has the same amount of votes as another state, which could be a lot bigger, could be much smaller, could have 10 times as many people. I think maybe we need to figure out what a state is. You know, a pretty good deal for some of them, North Dakota and South Dakota being a couple. And all they have to do is vote a particular way, and right away they have more control than the states with a huge amount of people. Doesn't seem very equal to me. Equal according to random borders and names of states. But when you have something as important as the gun registration issue, which died because of that, it's just It seems really incredible to me. Had we taken any kind of a vote based on population, where over 80% of the people support this, this would not have happened. But because of quote-unquote equal representation, that's why it died. Now, yeah, there's a lot of interesting history, like I said, with institutions of all sorts. But there are things that are wrong with all these institutions, things that do need to be changed. And obviously the Senate can't be the same thing as the House. There should be differences of one sort or another. But this is the only system quite like this in the world. And that's very nice. And it's amazing to have something so unique, but it doesn't mean it's perfect. We might be onto something, or we might be lagging behind. We always have to have a critical eye open. Okay, but thanks very much, Dave, for that letter. Here's another one. Yeah, we're getting a lot of mail. It happens. OTW@2600.com. It could be you next time. This listener writes in to say, I was listening to last week's show. You said the senators for West Virginia voted against the bill. I don't believe this is correct, since one of the authors of the bill was a senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, who was a Democrat, signed. Let me try to read that. Signed Eric from Ghent, I believe, or maybe you're saying you're a gentleman and abbreviating it. G-E-N-T, period. I don't know. But thank you for that letter. And if I said that, I was wrong. Yes. I might have included West Virginia as an example of a small state with a disproportionate amount of power in the Senate that many times might vote a particular way. But since they do have half of their state represented by a Democratic senator, odds are that that's not happening in that particular case. So that might have been a misstatement. I didn't listen back to that particular show. But again, thanks for that letter. And here's one more. Dear Emanuel, I've always found it nonsensical that quote-unquote gun people use the Second Amendment as justification for gun ownership. I thought it obvious that the Second Amendment isn't about people having guns. It's about the founders' opposition to standing armies. Madison based much of his work on the Constitution on the Virginia... Hang on, let me read that sentence in a better way. Madison based much of his work on the Constitution on the Virginia... I'm going to try it a third time. It's just, it's the emphasis is all wrong. Madison based much of his work on the Constitution, on the Virginia Constitution, and the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And the equivalent amendment in that document spells things out more clearly. All right, let's listen. Item 13, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people, trained to arms, is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. That standing armies in time of peace should be avoided as dangerous to liberty, and that, in all cases, the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. Interesting. Very interesting. Continuing here, after the Second World War, when a standing army became policy for the United States, the Second Amendment should have been nullified. I'm also perplexed why gun people assume that the word arms in the Second Amendment is interpreted as handguns and rifles and today's status quo as far as their regulation. This doesn't make sense, as the Bill of Rights were assembled over 200 years ago, and exactly what 21st century small arms would consist of could not be foreseen. So even if the Second Amendment were about guns, which it really isn't, then there would be only two logical ways to interpret the word arms as it is contained. Either it means the arms that were available at the time, or arms as befit a contemporary military force. In the first case, arms would therefore be limited to muzzle-loading, smooth-bore guns. And in the latter case, people should have open access to not only automatic weapons, but missiles, bombs, drones, nuclear weapons, and all the other accoutrements of a modern fighting force. I don't think gun people, at least not the mostly sane ones, would want that. I can think of a few moderately sane ones that would argue for that, actually. Yeah, why should the governments have all the fun? Why can't we have a personal nuke or two? Anyway, that leaves us, Congress, again, let me read the sentence better, this emphasis is all off. That leaves us Congress, the courts, and the states with the power and responsibility not only to limit quote-unquote arms, but to define what exactly the term refers to. So, and the short version of this, or as this writer said, who did not sign his name, so I'm not going to read any email address or anything like that, the TLDR, too long didn't read, that's what that means. TLDR version, the Second Amendment does not apply in the gun debate. Interesting viewpoint, and said better than I could say. So thanks, everybody, for for your input and for your ideas and for having the dialogue, because it's important. Now, the dialogue made an interesting shift this week. You probably heard about this story where all of a sudden there was this new technology. Well, it's not all of a sudden. We kind of saw it coming. Plastic guns? Well, not really plastic guns, but guns that you can print yourself with a 3D printer. Yeah, and right away, various politicians have jumped up and spoken out against this. Senator Charles Schumer, our senator, being one of the first, he said yesterday he's putting his full support behind legislation aimed at stopping the production of undetectable plastic guns that can be made using relatively cheap 3D printers. You know, like MakerBots and things like that. A Texas-based libertarian group has successfully been able to produce a functioning plastic handgun using a 3D printer that anyone could purchase. Schumer says the group plans to post on the internet how to go about making this cheap but functioning weapon that could pass through metal detectors at airports and elsewhere. He said he's joining Representative Steve Israel of Huntington, who has pushed for new legislation in this area. Right now, if you are a terrorist, you can buy one of these 3D printers and make guns, Schumer said. If you are a felon, you can make these guns. It's perfectly legal. We have to stop this. I know, there's something about whenever a politician says something, even if you agree with him, it just kind of rankles you. You know what I mean? It's, I don't know. It's just, sometimes it's best to just let the people have the conversation and reflect on that. But this is fascinating. This is really interesting. I went to their website, the people that are behind this. It's, let's see, what is it? It's defdist.org. Defense Distribution, I guess, is what that stands for. Our plan, develop a fully printable firearm. Defense Distributed is organized to produce and publish information related to the 3D printing of firearms, beginning with little expertise and less financial backing. The group first believed this production would be a limited trial and error process. Fortunately, in recent months, our expertise and capabilities have been greatly supplemented, but the first order production goal remains the same: produce and publish a file for a completely printable gun, or as near to completely printable as actually possible with current technologies. You may have heard of printed rifle receivers and plastic Glock handguns, but this project imagines firearms only at their most essential. What printable configuration of geometrics and materials will allow for the reliable and safe firing of a single round of ammunition? And it goes on from there. And, you know, I gotta kind of admire what they're doing, because they're basically standing up and figuring something out, using technology in interesting ways. If you put the whole gun thing aside for a moment, it's interesting what they're doing. And I don't see anybody, at least not yet, and if I do, I will certainly not support them, but I don't see anybody saying we have to make it illegal to even tell people how to do this. And I'll tell you, if they did that, we'd be among the first, I think, to publish a schematic to show how something works, how something is done. But that doesn't mean that the actual end product is something that you support. Now, this is a game changer. This could be a game changer if it's something that is relatively easy, or becomes relatively easy, where anybody can simply print a gun, print a deadly weapon. And maybe a game changer is what we need to show how completely futile it is to try and figure it all out and have all this regulation and restriction and things like that. No, we need something bigger than that. We need to change who we are. We need to make it so that we don't live our lives this way. Of course, that's something I don't know how we'd even begin to try and do. But it's it might be a wake-up call that we really need. So, yeah, when you have a situation where, okay, you know, all of a sudden all this quote-unquote security that you got, it's not doing any good whatsoever. It's useless, pointless. Then you have to think of something else. And I'm stumped so far. I haven't thought of anything that that will fix this. But I do know that suppressing information is always wrong. And there's a very fundamental difference. People try to get me to say it's the same thing. You know, if you support free speech, you have to support walking around with guns. No, it's not the same thing at all. But I certainly support speech about this, and I support education and information being passed around freely. That is very different. And that is something that is most definitely worth fighting for. But the nonsense that we've been seeing, it's just basically a lot of people playing with toys and stockpiling and trying to get bigger than the other people and things like that. There's a story recently, a few days ago, a horrible story, about a five-year-old kid who killed his little sister with a rifle. And the thing that really, really annoyed me about this more than anything was finding out that, yeah, you know, they have, this is what's known as a rifle for a child. There actually is such a thing. There's a company that markets this. Children's rifles. And they don't fire balloons, they fire bullets. And this kid fired a bullet and killed his little sister. And, you know, I got to say, if you give a five-year-old a gun, you are a moron. A moron. No question about it. There are people in Kentucky, which is where this happened, that are upset that they're being castigated for this. This is our way of life. This is what we do. Well, if you do that, you're stupid. And I don't think everybody in Kentucky does that. Anyone who gives a toddler a gun, a weapon of death like that, I don't care how well-trained he is, he's five, for God's sake. And last week we were talking about the four-year-olds, all the four-year-olds that were involved with guns, and almost as if on cue, we've now switched to five-year-olds. It is really, really disturbing, and more than a little disgusting. Mm-hmm. And also, it reminded me to make a slight correction. When I was talking about the four-year-olds last week, I mentioned this one story about a guy who was killed by a cop after he attacked the cop for running over his four-year-old daughter. Yeah, horrible story. But I've read that in relation to the other stories about four-year-olds that were involved with guns. This was sort of a step removed from that. But actually, that story didn't happen recently. That happened almost a year ago. And I meant to mention this last week. I meant to mention that this is a symptom of another problem, which is completely unrelated to anything we're talking about. But when you go online sometimes and read news stories and Google News or the Daily News is a big offender, you often see references to other stories, but they don't put the dates on the stories. So you might, you know, be reading something about weather conditions and you'll see a story saying hurricane coming. And it's talking about Hurricane Irene from a couple of years ago, but they never took the story out. And there's no date except if you look really, you know, carefully, there's a tiny date underneath the byline. But many times you read the story before you see the date. And that's what I did in that case. I meant to mention that last week, but we ran out of time. So, yeah, that's also quite interesting. And what else? Well, Glenn Beck is in the news. He was depicting New York City Mayor Bloomberg as a Nazi during the National Rifle Association convention that took place this weekend. He raised a few eyebrows during his anti-gun law speech by comparing New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg to Hitler. Can't say I'm surprised that he'd stoop to that, but whatever. The provocative pundit criticized Mayor Bloomberg's efforts to enforce gun control during the NRA convention that took place in Houston by displaying an image of him giving a Nazi salute. When somebody argues for gun control, they are either living in self-imposed ignorance or they are just living an argument of control. I'm amazed how many of my New York friends have become absolute dopes and just will accept the soda ban, the popcorn ban, the salt ban. Yeah. It's funny how this guy is defending everything that's kind of dumb, you know, and unhealthy. And we have to cling to this because that's our right to be unhealthy and stupid. Really, you know, really isn't. Beck's polarizing anti-Bloomberg New York screed wasn't the only controversial moment at the convention, which was attended by around 70,000 people. Gun safety advocate and firearms instructor Rob Pincus advised members to keep weapons inside their kid's bedroom as a safety measure. Wait a minute. Gun safety. I'm not sure which side he's on. Gun safety advocate. I think he's one of their gun safety advocates. So you got to put it all in quotes. Because a firearm instructor as well. Okay, he actually advised members to keep weapons inside their kids' bedrooms as a safety measure. You know, you realize the debate is so insane when you're not sure if it's a joke or not, when they say something like this. But no, it's no joke. How about putting a quick access safe in your kid's room, he says. We have an emotional pushback to that. Here's my position on this. If you're worried that your kid is going to try to break into the safe that is in their bedroom with a gun in it, you have bigger problems than home defense. You know what? A lot of us do have bigger problems than home defense. It's called life. And a lot of messy stuff happens in life. And when you have a family, when you have kids, who knows? Who knows what's going to go on? And introducing guns into the mix, almost always a bad idea. Almost always. I think it's an interesting statistic, too, just something to think about, that more people have been killed in this country by four-year-olds with guns than by terrorists. Think about that. And I'm using terrorism in the definition that is widely accepted, meaning foreigners, not domestic terrorists who shoot up malls and movie theaters. Now, there's also a study that came out that says gun crime has plunged, even though Americans believe it's up. And I thought that was kind of interesting, too, and something that can be used by either side of the argument, because people who believe that that gun crime is out of control, well, in this particular case, the situation is not as bad as they thought. Why is that? It really stems, you know, to why the numbers are lower. It's because there is more gun control, perhaps? But the gun advocates will say, no, it's because there are more guns. There are more guns, but less of them are being used to kill people, meaning that you don't need gun control. Either side can jump on this. But it is interesting that the number has plunged anywhere from 30 to close to 50% since the 1990s. It's still way above any other country. But, yeah, that's an interesting statistic. Sorry if I seem a little bit distracted. I'm actually texting. I'm supposed to make a telephone connection, but we're going to try that in just a moment. But first, I'd like to read a couple of important news stories that came our way via Newsday, our local newspaper here. A Valley Stream man tried to cash in on a free Carvel ice cream coupon last Wednesday, police said. And he was charged with robbery and resisting arrest charges when he tried to take the ice cream cone. Now, he basically presented a free ice cream cone coupon, then he was told that the coupon had expired. He turned around and headed towards the exit without paying. The employee confronted him, and this guy punched him several times in the face, causing a laceration. And when officers arrived, this guy twisted his body, flailed his arms, and refused to be handcuffed. And this is a news story. Well, I guess being punched in the face is a bit of a news story, but still, it's an ice cream cone. Sometimes you got to pick your battles, you know, and I don't know. And meanwhile, a Northport middle school teacher was arrested a week ago, charged with endangering the welfare of a child. She was accused of grabbing a female student by the arm on the Thursday beforehand and pulling her. Wow. Grabbing a female student by the arm and pulling her. That's a crime now. That's unless they're just really bad at describing it. That is something. Here's a story. Air Force's sexual assault prevention chief arrested for sexual assault. Okay, you know, I'm not even going to get into that one. That's just depressing. All right, let's try and make a phone call here. Trying to connect with Kyle, actually, but our text messaging is not going well. We have a phone? Okay. Dial 9 to get out. Just going to try this twice. Try a landline, try a cell phone. If not, then we'll just move on. You'll get to hear his answering machine message if he doesn't answer. And that's what it looks like is going to happen. Okay, well, let's try the cell phone then. Sorry we're doing this, but this is what happens when you don't get text messages from people. It's a good thing I remember phone numbers too, isn't it? So many people don't these days. Would be nice too if the phone company connected the phone call. What's going on here? Okay, well, I guess we're not going to be talking to him this week. That's unfortunate. Because what I wanted to talk about was something that's near and dear to Carl's heart, and that is the Phibro bike ride, which took place this past Sunday. And I was a part of that for the second year in a row. And, wow, it was really, really incredible. It was something that I can't recommend enough that people take part in. Basically, as it says, five boroughs, all five boroughs, Manhattan, Queens, the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Staten Island. Did I get them all? Yeah, I think I did. You basically start off at the bottom of Manhattan, and you ride all the way up through Manhattan, through Central Park, cross over into the Bronx. You don't stay nearly as long in the Bronx as I would like to do. Come right back down the FDR Drive and go up the Queensboro Bridge. Over into Queens, up to Astoria, where you hit the halfway point and hang out for a few minutes at a rest stop right underneath the Triborough Bridge. And you continue, and you head south, back through Queens, into Brooklyn, and down through downtown Brooklyn, through the BQE, and over the Verrazano Bridge to Staten Island. And it's one of the rare times that Staten Island is the goal in my life is something to really look forward to. And I kid, Staten Island is an okay place. But after that, you ride to the Staten Island Ferry. Wait a couple of hours for that because there's several thousand people trying to do the same thing, and then you're back in Manhattan. It is if you're somebody who has not ridden a bike in a while, it's a great way to get back into it, and a great way to tell yourself that, wow, you know, I can really do this. 40 miles, it's nothing to sneeze at. It's a good amount. It's not horribly hilly. There are hills, and the hills are mainly on bridges. And what that means is that most of the time, it's fairly smooth sailing. There are a few times, though. There are a few times where you feel like, boy, this is hard. You know, the BQE, for instance, has a few hills that I forgot about. You don't think about this when you're in your car. You don't think about it when you're just driving around lazily and you realize that you're just getting from one point to another, not seeing the hills. But and then the thing that really is annoying or kind of, I guess, a little scary is knowing that the Verrazano is the last thing. And I remembered it from last year, the Verrazano being a very, very long approach, a very long hill. And just worrying about that the whole time, knowing that that is the final thing you have to get over. But in the end, in my case, I just paced myself and worked with gears, stopped when I felt like stopping, and I was fine. I was able to make it without having to walk my bike like a bunch of people were doing, and that's it feels really good. Of course, I hurt everywhere. The pain is actually starting to go away, but, you know, muscular aches from exerting yourself. But the more you do this, the less that happens. And I probably got more sunburn than anything else. And that sunburn came from waiting in the sun for the ferry, like I said, because there's massive lines in Staten Island for that. So, yeah, it was an event. It was, but here's the other thing. First of all, there was one tragic incident where a rider died riding up one of those hills at the Queensboro Bridge. And I got to say, you know, I found out about that. Actually, I found out about it in kind of a strange way. What they did was they made phone calls to everybody who was riding. And I was riding with somebody whose wife is well over 9 months pregnant, and he got a call from a 212 number while we're riding. We're in Astoria, and basically we had to pull over because, well, this could be an important phone call. And then I realized I got the same phone call on my phone. So it's unlikely the hospital will be calling me, so I realized that's something to do with the ride. We couldn't really listen to voicemail and figure out what they were trying to tell us. But what they were saying was that, the ride is basically delayed on one side of the Queensboro Bridge because of the incident that happened. But I just thought it was kind of odd that everybody who was riding would be getting a phone call, and you can't really pick up the phone while you're riding. But again, it was a really horrible thing to have happen, to hear about this guy who came from Michigan. Apparently he had a history of heart trouble, but got clearance from his doctor to do this. So it's you feel something because there's 32,000 people that you're riding with, but everybody is helping each other out. Everybody is basically working towards the same goal. And it's really kind of an uplifting thing. You're all on the same side. You're all taking care of each other. And to hear that this happened to somebody, to one of you, it's pretty emotional. And I'm not sure if anything like that ever happened before in this particular event, but it was definitely a sobering moment. The other thing that was very weird about this particular ride was the reaction to the whole Boston Marathon incident. This is what I was hoping would not happen, but I guess I was being a bit naive. They were told that, we can't bring all of these things that we used to be able to bring. We can't bring bags of any sort. We can't bring knapsacks. Can't bring filtration systems. You know, we're the riders. You know, the marathon, it wasn't the joggers who were blowing things up. It was a couple of lunatics on the side. You know, what are you doing for people in apartment buildings that were passing by? For people standing on the street? You know, the problem shouldn't be the cyclists. And also, you know what? This is completely ridiculous because if I wanted to blow something up, it wouldn't be that difficult. You know, it would not be difficult at all. You don't need massive bags. You don't need all the things that are being banned. It just created a bad mood, really, because people felt like they were being subjected to all this scrutiny that was really unnecessary. So there were helicopters, there were cops everywhere, and I think most people felt, okay, we're being taken care of, they're watching out for us, but it really is living in an environment of fear, where you assume something is going to happen, and then you're surprised when it doesn't. So the expectation becomes the worst of everything is the norm. And that's just sad. That's always sad when something like that happens. It was good. It was bad. It was definitely something to participate in, and I can't recommend that enough. And of course, you don't have to wait till next May for this to happen. You can ride in all sorts of local streets, but you got to be careful. You got to be careful doing this because for the first time, I rode in traffic in New York City because I had to get my bike into the city from here, and I learned a lot doing that because riding in a marathon is one thing. All the streets are closed that you're on, but riding when there are cars and buses and trucks all around you, that's profoundly different. And you have to be really, really alert. And you have to be signaling. You have to be paying attention to what's going on around you. And it's really, it's something that so many people don't do. And that's quite unfortunate. So when I was riding downtown, I was very careful to keep an eye out for other cars or vehicles of any sort and to signal. And I realized I don't see cyclists in New York City signaling, you know, sticking out your arm when you're going to turn in a particular direction and sticking out. You know, this is why I wanted to have Kyle on the phone. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to stick my arm to the right or hold it up if I'm signaling going to the right. So I could be signaling the wrong way. I don't know. But just basically being aware of what's on the road, who's on the road, and acknowledging them. And they do the same to you. And I found there was this courteousness that exists. And we call it good signaling. Good signaling, going back and forth between people, acknowledging their presence, thanking them when they let you through, not just giving them the bad signals when they do something they shouldn't do. And also, I got to crosswalks where their light was red and people wanted to cross. I stopped. And people were thanking me for stopping. What's with that? Isn't that the norm? Aren't bicycles supposed to stop at a red light when there's pedestrians crossing? Apparently that doesn't happen. So that's why it's treated with surprise when it does happen. And it shouldn't be that way. So, yeah, you know, I see a lot of people riding without helmets. I see people riding the wrong way, not paying attention to cars, trying to get into fights with cars, which is about the stupidest thing ever, scaring the hell out of pedestrians. And, you know, New York City is a very dangerous place to be riding in the first place. So you have to have your wits about you, or you will be a casualty. All right. You know, I did promise I'd take more phone calls, or any phone calls this week. So I'm opening up the phone line, 631-632-6901. If there's anything that you would like to say to us, please give a call. I will go into delay if we see the phones start lighting up, because it's expensive every time we go into delay, apparently. And I don't want to cost any more than I've already cost. And while we're doing that, 631-632-6901 is our telephone number. While we're waiting for those phone calls to come in, I was talking before about how we seem to embrace stupidity. And it seems like the governor of New Jersey is not doing that anymore, which is good. You know, I've admired some of the things that he's done. He was great after Sandy. And now he's trying to lose weight. And, it's a personal thing, profoundly personal thing. But he also serves as an example. And when you're as overweight as he is and seemingly not caring, that sends a message to people. So apparently that's changing. He said today he decided to have weight loss surgery so he could become healthier. And he spoke out for the first time since he told the New York Post that he secretly underwent a procedure in February. He said, "I'm doing it for my long-term health. This is about being healthier for the rest of your life." And he's running for a second term in November. He said the surgery had nothing to do with whether he'll run for president in 2016. "I've struggled with this issue for 20 years, Chris Christie told the newspaper. "For me, this is about turning 50 and looking at my children and wanting to be there for them." All right, I see we have phone calls coming in, so let's go into delay, and we'll be back in just a moment. And here we are in delay. And I just have to make sure that it worked before we actually start taking phone calls. 631-632-6901. Yes, it did work. So let's take our first phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Wall.
Hey. I wanted to give you a call and follow up on something that you had said last week.
Okay. Can you speak up just a little bit? Because
yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
Let me turn you down, too.
Yes.
You know, I hate to make you more depressed, but you were talking about the Senate last
week. No, go for it.
And one of the things you're talking about, you know, how inequitable the Senate is in terms of the voting rights, in terms of all of that. Well, you know, take a look at the Constitution itself in terms of amendments, and it's even worse. You can't, without unanimous consent, actually change the way that the Senate voting works. It's just very disappointing.
What does that mean, though, in English, like unanimous consent?
So, when you're amending the Constitution, you need 3/4 of all of the senators and then all of the reps in the House to be able to send the amendment out to the states. Once you do that, you need 3/4 of the states to ratify the amendment and to say, we're going to change this. So we're going to let 18-year-olds vote, or let women vote, or say, you know, we want to have alcohol again. But the Constitution actually says we're going to change the fact that every state gets a senator. Have to agree to it. So you have the situation where Delaware or Maryland can effectively stop anything that you want to do and actually make Congress be able to work.
It basically ensures that change will never happen, because you're never going to get 3/4 of the states to agree on anything.
Well, and that's exactly it. And if you have, you know, I looked at the numbers, you need 13 states can stop any amendment. And the smallest 13 states represent a total of less than 4.5% of the population. Look, if you're looking at that, you know, imagine trying to change the Constitution to actually allow reasonable gun regulation.
Yeah, no, it'll never happen that way. That'll never, and that's why we haven't seen any kind of amendment of anything major for something like 40 years.
Well, you know, the other issue is, and this is the other thing that I kind of wanted to touch on, is what you were talking about last week with how change happens incrementally. You know, and it's more than just you know, a bunch of people at Occupy going out and protesting against the bank for, you know, even a couple months. It's sustaining that sort of thing for years and years and finding ways to build on it and actually reach out to more people to do it. And unfortunately, you know, when it's not a moneyed interest doing it, there's just not that kind of ability to sustain something. Nor is there really the idea that that's what you need to do. I saw an article, I think it was in Alternet or something like that last week, where they were talking about the divide in the Occupy movement and how following Sandy, Occupy, or the people who've been involved with it, really came to the rescue.
Yes.
Building,
yes.
Started doing all of these great things. And then that caused a group, you know, groups of people within this sort of, you know, heterogeneous movement to say, oh, no, that's not what we want to do. We actually just need to protest the banks. Well, you know, you're not going to get anywhere doing that. And unfortunately, the people on the left don't get that.
It seems like a lot of them don't, and that's what frustrates me so much, because we just keep digging our heels in and not actually making progress for ridiculous reasons.
Well, it's not, you know, making progress has to be defined. That's not, you know, it's not enough to say we want change or we want the banks to change. You have to put something out there, and unfortunately people don't think about what are we actually going to put out there. You know,
it takes
time to build something.
Listen, I want to move on to another call, but I want to thank you very much for calling in.
All right, thank you. All right,
take care. And good evening, you're on Off the Wall.
Hi, Eric. This is Kyle calling long distance from
Kyle.
Seattle.
Well, Kyle, you know, wanted to talk to you through the whole show, not the last minute, but okay, let's make it good then. What do you got?
Yeah, I'll hang up and try again another time.
No, don't do that. You have 1 minute. Make it a minute that we'll remember.
I caught a little last bit of people talking about cycling, and you're expressing some of your feelings about the rules of the road and the way people are courteous and the different sides of human nature you get to see when you're out there in the world on some pedals and getting some fresh air.
Yes, definitely. Well, I wanted to thank you. That's what I wanted to do this hour, was thank you for getting me into this in the first place, because, you know, you've been cycling for a long time, and you cycle in Seattle, which really makes New York look like kid stuff. And, when we cycle together, I'm just amazed that I'm able to keep up or keep near. And it's something like that. When you have someone that is supportive, encouraging you to keep pushing yourself, that makes all the difference in the world, and we all have that ability. We can all do that for somebody else.
Well, I'm happy to have been the catalyst, and I just wanted to share something that I'm real interested in and see if maybe it's something that you couldn't get back into or something. You know, maybe it's been a while, you haven't been on the bike, and just encourage you to amaze yourself. That's the one thing, I know I've told you this before, but you can amaze yourself over and over again when you're out pedaling, you know, going a little further, a little faster, you know. As long as you're healthy, you get enough water and everything, and you're, you know, deliberate about, you know, your equipment and getting out there and safety, you can really push yourself and be amazed at how far or how long or just how much fun you can have.
Like you said, push yourself, but don't abuse yourself to the point where it's unhealthy. You've been pushing yourself a bit lately, and you've been amazing yourself by, I guess, getting further and just doing more than you've done. And there's no better feeling.
That's true. And, you know, it's that spirit of fun and exploration, too. You know, go down roads you don't normally go on in a car because it's not part of your commute. I do that. I get lost, you know. I go and find, like, the biggest hill I haven't been on and go give it a a good try, you know, and see if I can get up it. And
see, I don't know how you do that because hills are just... I did make it up the bridges without too much of a problem. And of course, it was horrible hearing about the guy that perished doing that. It's a strain. But what you have there in Seattle, you've got real hills, practically mountains.
Oh yeah,
and that's incredible. I don't think I could ever achieve that. Anyway, listen, Kyle, we're out of time. Sorry, but maybe in next week or some other time we can have a more thorough discussion. And hopefully you'll be back here fairly soon. I know everybody from bartenders to skateboarders are asking when you're going to be back. So hopefully sometime later this month we can do some more adventuring and things like that. But good to hear from you.
Absolutely. Likewise. When time's right, we'll see then.
All right. We are out of time. And Let's get out of delay first. Okay, yeah, we're late now, so we got to get out of here. OTW@2600.com. We'll see you next week. Good night.
I did my best to notice when the call came down the line. Up to the platform of surrender, I was brought, but I was kind. And sometimes I get nervous when I see an open door. Close your eyes, clear your heart. Cut the cord. Are we human? Or are we dancer? My sign is vital. My hands are cold. And I'm on my knees looking for the answer. Are we human? Or are we dancer?
Kids, Finn's Revolution with you until the 9 p.m. hour. Stay with us. We're going to be listening to tons and tons of music, including periodically over the course of the next 2 hours, celebrating the 100th birthday of the great, great Robert Johnson. Stay tuned. Weird stuff is ahead.
Walking on the streets where I was born. States, but again.